Hello, listeners. This is Salma Abu Ayash in for Dear Sharif Fam, and this is This Week in Palestine. Today is Sunday, December 20th, 2009. In a few days, most Christians around the world will be celebrating a holy day, Christmas. In Bethlehem, Palestine, the birthplace of Jesus Christ, Christmas has a bittersweet reality. It is where we find the Church of Nativity, one of the oldest continuously operating churches in the world. The structure is built over the cave that tradition marks as the birthplace of Jesus of Nazareth. It is actually three times holy, being revered by the followers of three of the world's religions, not just Christianity, as it contains the shrine of Rachel, and it is where the Prophet Muhammad prayed on his way to Jerusalem. He is reported as having said, "When I was taken on the midnight journey to Jerusalem, Gabriel took me to Bethlehem, saying, 'Alight and pray two rak'ahs, sets of prayers, for here is the birthplace of your brother Jesus, peace be upon him.' And then I was taken to the rock, i.e. Jerusalem." There is an 8-meter-high apartheid wall, twice as high as the Berlin Wall, and 760 kilometers, which is about 472 miles long wall, will be when completed. 85% of it is located in the West Bank, not on the Green Line of 67. And it will de facto annex some 46% of the West Bank, isolating communities into Bantustans, ghettos, and military zones. Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus Christ, is no exception. Towering walls and militarized fences now encircle Bethlehem, turning the 4,000-year-old city into a virtual prison for its Palestinian Christian and Muslim citizens. Bethlehem has only three gates in Israel's apartheid wall that surrounds it, all tightly controlled by the Israeli army. In the last few years, Israel has confiscated almost all the agricultural land in the city and surrounding areas, making it impossible for farmers to access their groves. These agricultural gates, quote-unquote, in the wall, do not provide any guarantee that farmers will have access to their remaining lands, but instead strengthen Israel's strangling system of permits and checkpoints where Palestinians are beaten, detained, shot at, and humiliated. This is the reality of Bethlehem. With us here today to talk more about this and the reality of living in the West Bank is Dr. Mazen Qumsiyeh. Dr. Mazen Qumsiyeh, he is a PhD, born to a Palestinian Christian family in the Shepherd's Field. And he splits his time between the USA and Palestine, actually between the world and Palestine. He served on the faculty of both Duke and Yale universities, 6 and 5 years respectively. He served on the steering executive committees of a number of groups, including the U.S. Campaign to End the Occupation, Association for One Democratic State in Israel-Palestine, AcademicsForJustice.org, BoycottIsraeliGoods.org, and he's also the head of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement or Rapprochement Between People, PCR.PS. He published over 200 letters to the editor and 100 op-ed pieces and interviewed in TV and radio extensively, local, national, and international. Appearances in national media included The Washington Post, New York Times, Boston Globe, CNBC, ABC, etc. He is also regularly lecturing on issues of human rights and international law. He teaches in Bethlehem and Beer Zeit University. Dr. Mazen Qumsiyeh, as I said, joins us from Bethlehem in Palestine. Dr. Qumsiyeh, welcome to our program This Week in Palestine, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
Dr. Qumsiyeh, please tell us a little bit about the mood in Bethlehem. Are people getting ready to celebrate? And I mean, do people celebrate in this harsh reality of their occupation?
Well, the area of Bethlehem, as you described it, is really in a somber mood. The celebrations for Christmas have been, for the past few years, restricted to religious observances, and people go to the churches, and they have family gatherings and so forth, but we don't see the kind of festive Christmas events that I remember from my childhood here before the Israeli occupation. So it has changed over the years, and unfortunately what we have is a city under siege that observes a religious holiday because it's the birth of Jesus Christ, but is not in a celebratory mood, so to speak.
I read just now about an event you're holding called Shepherd's Nights. Can you tell us a little bit about what the people of Bethlehem are planning for that event?
In Palestine, Palestinians are generally very supportive of people who are oppressed anywhere they are, and certainly when they are in Palestine itself, we support each other because we're all under the same knife, if you like, of the occupation and colonization. So this year we are planning a Shepherd's Night activities that are going to be 23rd, 24th, and 25th of December, basically this week, and we will be dedicating these nights to Jerusalem, to the issue of Jerusalem, because Jerusalem, especially this year, is under intensified attacks and intensified efforts of what I call de-Palestinizing, in other words, remove the Palestinians from Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Just in the past year alone, over 4,500 Palestinians lost their residency rights in Jerusalem mm-hmm. and basically were kicked out of Jerusalem. And Israel continues to intensify its efforts to change the city into a Jewish city instead of a multi-ethnic, multi-religious city. So the Shepherd's Night's idea is to recognize that the shepherds saw the star, went up to Bethlehem where Jesus was born, the shepherds who were watching over their sheep, and we still have a few places where shepherds are still around here. And we recognize that the Prince of Peace was born in Bethlehem, and we ask for peace and justice for ourselves, obviously, but also for the people of Jerusalem and for the people of Gaza who are under siege. So that's the idea of the Shepherd's Night.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Not long ago, it was the International Human Rights Day. Israel's violations make a mockery of this day. There is an ICJ, International Court of Justice, ruling regarding the apartheid wall which surrounds Bethlehem and snakes through the West Bank. What can you tell us about this wall for you as a resident of Bethlehem who is faced probably daily with it? How does it affect you psychologically, how does it affect the lives of Palestinians in material terms?
Well, the Bethlehem district has already lost 80% of its land to the colonial settlements. So the population of Bethlehem was reduced to 20%, to use of 20% of its land. And we have in the Bethlehem district over 125,000 people. More than half of them are refugees or displaced people who have been squeezed into this, as I said, smaller area, tiny area of its previous land of Bethlehem. So on this 20% of the land where 125,000 people live, surrounded by walls and security barriers and checkpoints and so forth, life has become very, very difficult. And there is about 40% unemployment in the mm-hmm. Bethlehem district. As a whole, and the poverty rate, more than half the children actually in the Bethlehem district live below the poverty line, which means families that have less than $2 a day, basically. Mm-hmm. And so the situation economically is very, very difficult. But there is also additional inconveniences, for example, traveling from one place in the West Bank to another. I, as a Palestinian, for example, I actually cannot enter Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. Jerusalem is forbidden to me. Even though I have a U.S. citizenship, which is unusual for Palestinians to have U.S. citizenship, but to have a U.S. citizenship and not be able to enter Jerusalem is another oddity of our situation. But even going in other places in the West Bank, like going from Bethlehem to Ramallah, which is not Jerusalem, and Ramallah is, we are faced by checkpoints along the way. The normal route would have taken less than maybe 45 minutes or an hour, and now it takes 2 hours if you're, if things are moving along. This is again because of the walls and the checkpoints that have been instituted, as you described earlier, not along the green line, which is the border, as Israel was established in 1949, but deep inside the West Bank in places like around Bethlehem and around Ramallah and around Hebron and other cities.
I see. I actually did read a report on Ma'an News from December 16th, just days before Bethlehem's busiest tourist season begins. Israeli authorities implemented a ban on foreign passport holders traveling to Jerusalem on Palestinian buses from Bethlehem. This is Line 21, Mazen, a route used predominantly by holders of East Jerusalem residency cards. They are stopped for inspection at the Jerusalem tunnel entrance into Israel. What amazed me is that this time, Palestinians holding the East Jerusalem, Jerusalem residency cards were allowed to continue, but actually the foreign tourists were harassed and almost punished for using Palestinian transportation, and thus I guess they're coaxing them instead to use the Israeli transportation services. Have you heard about this or about similar tactics to steal business from Palestinians in Bethlehem?
Yes, and there's a lot of my friends and colleagues, and also my wife, who is not a Palestinian citizen. She's not allowed to, by the Israelis, to have a Palestinian citizenship yet. But she holds an American passport, and she is not allowed anymore on bus 21 going to Jerusalem. So, yes, the idea is an economic warfare on the Palestinians, basically. Tourists coming to the Holy Land are being co-opted into Israeli tourist companies. In fact, Israel does not issue permits for Palestinians to become tour guides. There is hundreds and hundreds of Israeli tour guides and tour buses and so forth, but there is only 40 authorized Palestinian tour guides, and those are aging tour guides who were there before early 70s and so forth. And so Israel kind of takes the tourism economy to capitalize on it and use it also in its war against the Palestinians. So they don't mind that tourists come and visit the Church of Nativity, but they have Israeli tour guides take them and Israeli tour buses take them, and also even buying souvenirs, not in Palestinian shops, but in Israeli places and so forth. The idea is, again, to deprive the Palestinians of a viable economy and force us to abandon our land and leave for other places so that they can have this land to become a Jewish-owned area.
Yeah, I actually, I mean, we should probably tell our listeners that the city's main income depends on the Christian pilgrims and tourism. And locally here in the malls around the Boston area, I've often found Israeli vendors selling the traditional olive wood sculptures that for hundreds of years Palestinians used to still sell in their shops in Bethlehem. It's quite disturbing seeing all this. I want to see if you can tell us a little bit about Rachel's tomb and how its occupation. It's always amazed me how the wall sort of snakes around it and how Israel, you know, sort of claimed it within its own territory, and it's being isolated from the rest of Bethlehem. How does that really weird action affect the life in the rest of the city, like simply surrounding the wall, surrounding the tomb? How does it affect the rest of the city?
Well, when Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967, Israel shortly afterwards annexed East Jerusalem. Not only annexed the old city of East Jerusalem, but also expanded the borders of East Jerusalem and annexed those areas too. Mm-hmm. And those areas happen to be the areas between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. Bethlehem to Jerusalem, the distance is only six miles. Mm-hmm. And in those areas, Israel has confiscated pretty much all the agricultural lands in those areas. Rachel's tomb happens to be very close to built-up areas of Jerusalem, of Bethlehem, and away from Jerusalem. So Israel wanted to get the areas between Jerusalem and Rachel's tomb, and include also Rachel's tomb. So obviously they built the wall to solidify the fact that they confiscated these lands and stole these lands from their rightful owners, the Palestinian owners. As far as the tomb itself, it, as you pointed out earlier, it's a religious site that's highly respected by Christians, Muslims, and Jews. In
Correct.
Fact, there's a Muslim cemetery right next to it because the Muslims recognized Rachel as they recognize all the prophets in previous history. So Israel annexed this area and established essentially a settlement, a small settlement, which consists of a yeshiva, a religious study site for the Orthodox Jewish community to come to Rachel's tomb, and made it off limits to Christians and Muslims of the Bethlehem area.
Mm-hmm.
So I myself, again, cannot visit Rachel's tomb, even though it's just visibly across from me, unfortunately, behind the wall now.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, also Israel ended up taking not only the agricultural land of the Bethlehem district, but also a number of houses and souvenir shops and so forth that used to be around Rachel's tomb that belonged to Palestinians, and annexed those to Israel itself also, or what they hoped to get in Israel.
Yeah, I find it a very striking example of Israel's wish to enact the system of separation, system of apartheid. As you said, this tomb has existed in that piece of land along with all other religious sites of the three different religions, and they all seem to have coexisted nicely, except that Israel wants to separate. It's a stark example of apartheid, as I said. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about the effect of the wall with respect to the water aquifers around Bethlehem, to how does it affect nature, environment, anything else you want to say about the wall from that point of view?
Yes, actually, you're probably asking me because my background is in biology.
Definitely.
So I know a little bit about the environmental issues.
Yes, please.
I actually just returned from a trip to Lebanon, where we discussed the Israeli use of water resources in the River Jordan Basin. And of course, Israel now uses 80% of the water of the West Bank. Now, the West Bank and Gaza together, we have to remember, are 22% of Palestine. This is the area of Palestine that Israel didn't conquer until 1967. And in this area, Israel has, contrary to international law, proceeded to take natural resources from this area and also to move its population as colonial settlers inside the West Bank to utilize even more resources. So 80-plus percent of West Bank water, which is underneath our feet as Palestinians, is being used by the Israeli colonialists in settlements and also inside the Green Line itself. In the Bethlehem district, essentially some 70% of the wells are under Israeli control. So it's very hard for us to continue to function, and there's water shortages almost every day here for Palestinians.
I am going to actually cover a little bit about the mood in Europe. You mentioned you were in Beirut, but I also know you were in Spain, I believe, on a talking tour just 1 week ago. The EU foreign ministers endorsed a document promoting compliance with international human rights law, which concluded with the promise that, quote, the European Union will continue to do its utmost to promote an international order where no state or individual is above the law and no person is outside the protection of the law. So you were in Spain and probably, I don't know, if other countries too. What is the current mood about Israel and its flagrant human rights violations in Europe today as you have witnessed it?
Yes, it was my first visit to Spain, but I have been to many other parts of Europe, and in Barcelona and Madrid I spoke to good-sized audiences, and I am actually amazed at how much the public in Europe supports the Palestinian cause.
Mm.
Unfortunately, the story is not the same among the governments in Europe. The governments seem to be more spineless and just subjugated to American pressure, and of course the American government itself is under pressure from the Israel First lobby in Washington, so it's kind of hard to apply international law and human rights
I would like to tell our listeners that you can join Dr. Komsia's newsletter, which is an amazing, informative insight into what it's like to be living in the West Bank by going to lists.kumsieh.org and clicking on human rights. Thank you so much, Dr. Komsieh. We wish you a pleasant holiday, as pleasant as possible under the severe circumstances you are enduring. I greatly admire your work and your smooth perseverance and resistance, and we look forward to hearing more from you on your newsletter.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, Dr. Komsieh. So before I go on to any other news, I need to urgently tell you about the upcoming Gaza Freedom March and the local Boston activity on First Night. As you may know, 1 year ago, Israel launched a 22-day ferocious military attack against the 1.5 million residents of the Gaza Strip, the majority of whom are children. More than 1,400 Gazans were killed in the attacks. Since then, Gaza has been a closed prison as Israel, with the blessing of the U.S., has maintained its nearly four-year-long blockade of Gaza. The Palestinians in Gaza are being forced to live in the wreckage of the war, with essential supplies being smuggled from Egypt through dangerous handmade tunnels. This year in Gaza, an historic Gaza Freedom March will take place on December 31, 2009. Some 1,400 internationals from 43 countries, including 14 participants from Massachusetts, will be marching with the Palestinian people to call for an immediate end of the siege. Marchers include an 85-year-old American Holocaust survivor, Hedy Epstein, the acclaimed writer Alice Walker, civil rights movement veteran Ronnie Castrell from South Africa. He's actually a leader of South African liberation struggle, and a substantial delegation from the Congress of South African Trade Unions will be there. In addition to that, Nawato Amaki, former Japanese ambassador, Anne Wright, which is she's a retired U.S. colonel, Walden Bello, a Filipino MP, MAP, is a French rap group, will be in this march, Doreid Laham, a famous Syrian actor and director, Roger Waters, musician from Pink Floyd, and among many others. As I said, 1,400 people are going to be joining arms with Palestinians to try to end the siege by marching marching into Gaza. What's happening here in Boston to mark this anniversary, the one-year anniversary, and in solidarity with the March on Gaza? We have a First Night Against the Wars, Let Gaza Live event. We will be standing out in solidarity with those who are marching in Gaza. We too will raise our voices to call for an end of the siege of Gaza. This is happening at Copley Square, corner of Boylston and Dartmouth Streets, and it's happening on First Night, December 31st, from 4 to 7 p.m. There will be a vigil at 4 p.m., At 6 p.m., we will be joining the end of the First Night parade and marching to Park Street. Please do wear black. And if you can, also plan to be there between 1 and 4 to help hand out End the Siege of Gaza flyers and stickers at the Stop the Wars Coalition encampment in Copley Square. Again, that's corner of Boylston and Dartmouth Streets, First Night, 4 to 7 p.m. And if you come earlier, you can help us with our leafleting. Soon these details will be on the GazaFreedomMarch.org. Click on Solidarity Actions and search for this one event. It will also be posted on the BCPR.net website, BCPR.net website shortly. I urge you to read Dr. Nancy Murray's article, The Gaza I Know, which was published December 18th. On the nation.com website. Nancy Murray was with us last week as a speaker on our show. She's president of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation and a member of the International Steering Committee of the Gaza Freedom March. And after you read it, please write a thank you letter to The Nation magazine. Again, that's thenation.com. It's very rare that we have such voices actually given space in printed material and on the web in such esteemed newspapers. or magazines. So the Gaza Freedom March needs your support. You can go to gazafreedommarch.org and learn how you can support it. Also, in reference to Gaza, I mentioned this last week and I'll mention it again. Senators Jim McDormand and Keith Ellison have circulated a letter to be signed by members of the Congress asking President Obama to work for improved conditions for the residents of the Gaza Strip. I will spend, I'm not sure if I should spend that time giving you the numbers. I can tell you who our representatives are. Actually, let me just do it. The area code is 202. The number starts with 225. And I will be giving you the last four digits extensions for our Massachusetts representatives. So that's 202, 225, and then the following. For Capuano, it's 9322. For Delahunt, it's 5658. For Frank, it's 0182. For Lynch, it's 3984. McGovern, it's 5759. Neil, 8112. Tierney, 5915. A few of them have a slightly different number. Again, it's 202-226, and then the following four digits, Oliver, 1224, Markey, 0092, and Songas, 0771. Please do call them and or urge them to sign that letter that's being circulated about Gaza and ending the siege on Gaza. I am interested today to talk to you further about the climate or the mood in Europe as of recent with respect to Israel. In a nutshell, it's mixed, but it's hopeful. That is, it's hopeful for human rights and justice. First of all, on December 14th, The Guardian published this article with the title, British Court Issued Gaza Arrest Warrant for Former Israeli Minister Tzipi Livni. Yes, indeed, an arrest warrant. Somehow this was not deemed news for our objective and enlightened major media sources. Tzipi Livni, as you know, as you might know, was a member of the war cabinet during Operation Cast Lead, a.k.a. Slaughter of Gaza, winter 2008-2009. And currently she is the leader of Kadima, which is the biggest party in Israel. She had been due to address a meeting in London on Sunday, but cancelled her attendance in advance. The Guardian has established that Westminster Magistrates Court issued the warrant at the request of lawyers acting for some of the Palestinian victims of the fighting, but it was later dropped because she wasn't coming into London after all. This is big news, but not for our media, apparently. In an imagined letter by Daniel Makover, he's an Israeli writer living in London, again, a Guardian article from December 16 titled, What David Miliband, British Foreign Secretary, Should Say to Tzipi Livni, who obviously complained about this arrest warrant, he imagines David Miliband writing the following. These are just excerpts from this article. Quote, it does seem, however, that a judicial decision was taken that there exists a reasonable suspicion that you committed a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which is a criminal offense under the Geneva Conventions Act 1957. Moreover, the Attorney General would have to take into account this country's solemn treaty obligations under Article 146 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which states that we're under the obligation to search for persons alleged to have committed or to have ordered to be committed grave breaches and shall, in other words, it's a mandatory, shall bring such persons, regardless of their nationality, before our courts. Now, he continues that regarding the Goldstone report, we cannot ignore its conclusions that from the fact that it gathered, great breaches of the Fourth Geneva Conventions do appear to have been committed by Israeli armed forces in Gaza, including willful killing. And he specifically refers to paragraph 1975. The Goldstone report recommended that, quote, state parties to the Geneva Convention should start criminal investigations in the national courts using universal jurisdiction where there is sufficient evidence of the commission of grave breaches, end quote. Indeed, the arrest warrant against Livni signifies a modest breakthrough in the efforts of activists worldwide towards the realization of justice long denied to the Palestinian people. Alas, this imagined letter is not what Miliband have responded to this arrest warrant from the judicial system in in London from an excellent article from the Electronic Intifada on December 18, 2009, titled "Net Around Israeli War Crimes Suspects Tightens." The article goes, "In an affront to the independence of the British judiciary, Foreign Minister David Miliband promised Israel a legal fix to guarantee immunity for Israeli officers. Upon Netanyahu's appeal for a worldwide campaign to lobby for changes in the international laws of war, Spain enacted a bill last month to limit the reach of its universal jurisdiction laws, which, by the way, as I mentioned, they're required. You shall bring such persons, regardless of their nationality, before the courts." So they're working to actually change their laws or international laws in order not to do that. This move was a response to Israeli pressure following the opening of a war crimes probe against Israeli officers in Spanish courts. This is despite the UK and Spain's cooperation in the application of universal jurisdiction in the case of, example, Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet a decade ago. Miliband's intent to change the law to appease Israel would be a setback not only for Palestine but for all other cases around the world deserving a fair hearing. All of this to satisfy Israel. Anyway, the purpose of universal jurisdiction, the article goes on, is to hold accountable in third-party states individuals suspected of war crimes from states that do not fulfill their obligations under international humanitarian law. The events of World War II showed the horrific consequences of the absence of the protection of civilians, leading to the adoption of the Fourth Geneva Convention in 1949, dealing with the laws of armed conflict. State signatories to the convention are obliged to enforce, as I said, and ensure the respect of international humanitarian law or the law of armed conflict. The authoritative commentary on the Fourth Geneva Convention, published by the International Committee and Red Cross, confirms that countries have an obligation. It follows that this duty should include maintaining border controls that enable a state to ensure that known suspects seeking to enter the jurisdiction are arrested upon arrival. So, you know, issuing an arrest warrant for Tzipi Livni is within the realms of international law. The article continues, "The Goldstone report concluded that there was strong enough evidence that Israel committed war crimes and crimes against humanity in the Gaza Strip, and as I said, Tzipi Livni, it was part of the war machinery during that time, and therefore the 194 states that signed the Geneva Conventions carry the responsibility to actively search for suspected war criminals and bring them before the courts." The article continues to chronicle the many arrests warrants issued against Israeli leaders and members of the armed forces and cabinet that went nowhere, as third-party states with universal jurisdiction laws have frustrated efforts to bring Israeli war crime suspects to their national courts. So the courts follow the rules for international law, but the governments stand up and stop this justice from taking its course. And the article ends with this paragraph: "After World War II, many countries fulfilled their duties to try in court suspects of war crimes and crimes against humanity. The principles of universal jurisdiction, a direct result of a renewed sense of duty to humanity and to universal justice following the horrors of the Holocaust, made this possible, actually. However, Israel is now leading the efforts to revoke these laws while governments continue to fuel Israel's exceptionalism. The arrest warrant against Livni signifies, as I said, a modest breakthrough towards the realization of justice long denied to the Palestinian people." For us Palestinians, for people seeking justice, this was big news, but for American media, apparently it was not. Another piece of news from Europe, as I said, I'm focusing on European news for a little bit, just to give you an idea of the difference maybe of how things operate here and there. And Haaretz.com, from an article December 19th, "Government officials in Jerusalem harshly criticized the new European Union High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Catherine Ashton, for her scathing remarks about the Israeli occupation in her maiden speech. Ashton on Tuesday leveled scathing criticism at Israeli policy in her first speech as the European Union's first High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policies. The British stateswoman, who has also served as the Commissioner for Trade in the European Commission, said said that in the EU's view, East Jerusalem is occupied territory together with the West Bank. Ashton demanded that Israel immediately lift its blockade on the Gaza Strip and reiterated that the Union opposes the existence of the West Bank separation fence as it opposes evictions of Palestinians from their homes in East Jerusalem. The stateswoman, whose full title is Baroness Ashton of Upholland, also only defined Israel's partial freeze of West Bank settlement construction as a first step, as opposed to the warmer description of the move by EU foreign ministers who last week took positive note of it. Ashton said she told Blair personally that the quartet, which is a special group set up by the US, EU, UN, and Russia, must demonstrate that it's worth the money that it is capable of being reinvigorated. The quartet was supposed to handle the peace process in Palestine, Israel. Following her comments, a number of MEPs, members of EU Parliament, from the liberal side of the House called for punitive measures against Israel, including the suspension of the EU's association agreement, and the Irish centre-left member, I cannot say the first name, something De Rosa, who visited the West Bank last week, called Israel's treatment of Palestinians a form of apartheid. This is language that you rarely, if ever, see in told by any kind of American representative. It is the truth. It is apartheid. Occupation of West Bank and Jerusalem is illegal, but for some reason our own representatives shy away from such language. And an article from December 8, 2009, EU... Jerusalem should be capital of two states, is the title. It's on BBC again. Jerusalem's status is a core dispute between Israel and Palestinians. European Union ministers have called for Jerusalem to serve as the capital of both Israel and a future Palestinian state as part of a negotiated peace. The foreign ministers dropped an earlier reference stating explicitly that East Jerusalem should be the capital of a Palestinian state. Palestinians welcomed the statement, but Israel said it contained nothing new. In other words, we'll just ignore this statement. The EU Foreign Affairs Council is quoted as saying the council is deeply concerned about the situation in East Jerusalem, as Mazen has talked to us about 4,000 people in East Jerusalem has lost their right of residency and many have been evicted from their homes recently. It also calls on the Israeli government to cease all discriminatory treatment of Palestinians. Furthermore, on Friday, December 11th, UK food labels are set to distinguish between goods from Palestinians in occupied territories and produce from Israeli settlements. This was, again, an article on the BBC. The UK unions have voted to boycott Israeli settlement goods. UK food labels are set to distinguish between goods from Palestinians in occupied territories and produce from Israeli settlements. The government said it was opposed to a boycott of Israeli goods, but as I said, but that the settlements pose an obstacle to peace. And as I said, meanwhile, the UK unions have voted to boycott Israeli settlement goods. So this is sort of a quick overview of a few things that happened as statements by leaders in the European Union in the past couple of weeks. What is happening on the other side of the Atlantic here in our beloved country, the USA? I'm going to use Stephen Walt's blog to refer to some latest news. Stephen Walt, as some of you might know, is a professor of international affairs at Harvard University's John F. K. Kennedy School of Government. He co-authored The Israel Lobby and the U.S. Foreign Policy with John Mersheimer. He writes on his blog on Wednesday, December 16th. The title of this blog is "The Smallest Minds, Selfishest Souls, and the Cowardliest Hearts That God Makes," end quote. His blog goes on like this. Yesterday, that would be December 15th, our distinguished and highly principled House of Representatives passed H.R. 2194, the Iran Refined Petroleum Sanctions Act, IRPSA. The new measure is the brainchild of Representative Howard Berman, Democrat from California, and the best one can say for it is that it is a foolish bit of political posturing. As Laura Friedman of Americans for Peace Now and Matt Duss at the Center for American Progress make clear, This act will do virtually nothing to change the Iranian government's behavior or weaken the political grip of the clerics and revolutionary guards. Instead, it will undoubtedly cause a lot of suffering among ordinary Iranians and reinforce the widespread perception that Uncle Sam is indifferent to the suffering of others. It will also complicate U.S. efforts to get stronger multilateral sanctions on Iran, and is therefore counterproductive to any broader effort to address Iran's nuclear ambitions. And you might rest assured that when this new set of sanctions fails, hardliners will argue that, quote, we've tried everything, end quote, and that we must therefore rely on other options, i.e. preventative war. Yes, more wars. That's what this act means. It's not like Congress was unaware of some of these counter-arguments. For example, all four witnesses at a Tuesday hearing before the House National Security and Foreign Affairs Subcommittee said they would vote against the legislation if given the option. But these expressions of sanity could not stop the stampede to folly. AIPAC endorsed and pushed this. AIPAC is the American-Israeli PAC, the Israeli lobby in our country. AIPAC endorsed and pushed this, the legislation, and probably wrote its details for Representative Howard Berman. But so did the J Street new lobby, the self-advertised pro-peace, pro-Israel lobby that appears to be trimming its sails more and more with each passing month. Stephen Wald continues, needless to say, the act passed overwhelmingly 412 to 12, with four others voting present, as with almost every other act in favor of Israel. There's no distribution of votes on these issues. It's always overwhelming in the favor of Israel. No wonder Mark Twain, Stephen Wald continues, once complained that Congress contains, quote, the smallest minds and the selfishest souls and the cowardliest hearts that God makes, with maybe 16 exceptions in this case. A commentator on his blog says, even if China and Russia were to sign on, there's no guarantee that other oil producers, aka Sudan and Venezuela, would not sabotage the entire embargo. Hugo Chavez has already stated that he will send 20,000 barrels of refined gasoline per day to Iran in the event of an economic blockade. Perhaps we should endorse, this blogger says, a more realistic approach to dealing with the Iranian nuclear problem. How about nuclear deterrence in the Middle East and an enhanced U.S.-Arab security relationship? I don't know if people know, Israel has a very strong nuclear program itself and actually the only nuclear power in the Middle East. Contrary to what Israeli lobbyists would like us to believe, Iran is a relatively rational state, according to this blogger, in the international system. Yes, they talk about, quote-unquote, wiping Israel off the map, but surely they understand that doing so would mean the complete annihilation of Iran as both a country and a society. And I don't think nuclear war is really in the plans for Iran. Using nuclear weapons is an aggressive way, surely does not serve Khomeini and Ahmadinejad's primary interest of self-preservation and regime control. By the way, Massachusetts Representative Lynch was one of the 12 no votes on the Iran Refined Petroleum Sanctions Act, the only one from Massachusetts that voted no. Of course, Conyers and Kucinich were among the 12 exceptions to Twain's description of members of Congress. And by the way, I don't know if you've been hearing me raving about the impeccable record of Representative Kucinich. Conyers is one that I also admire. He's the second longest serving member of the House. And although he's the first member of the Black Caucus to endorse President Obama over Hillary Clinton, he said in response to Obama asking him to stop, quote unquote, demeaning him, he said, I've been saying I don't agree with him on Afghanistan. I think he screwed up on healthcare reform, on Guantanamo, etc. He's been standing up basically to the president whom he endorsed during the elections on these issues. Anyway, I digress. So please let Representative Lynch know you appreciate his stance. His office number in D.C. is 202-225-8273. And while you're at it, urge John Kerry to put a hold on this in the Senate. His phone number is, and I didn't write it down. Anyway, it's very easy to find. Oh, there it is. It's 202-224-2742. it is very easy to find numbers on the web. I don't know if you know why, and that's because they expect you, the constituents, to give them a call every now and then. So this is a good chance to call Representative Lynch and let him know you appreciate his stance against waging war on Iran. As I said, as a clarification, this act will achieve nothing, and the warmongers will come back and say, well, we tried sanctions, it didn't work, just like they did in Iraq. We need to wage war again, and we don't need this war. But really what amazes me is how indiscreet AIPAC is about its actions. I found on Politico.com an article by Andrew Glass, which describes AIPAC's push for a resolution against Iran. The article goes as such. There are challenging times for AIPAC. These are challenging times for AIPAC, the nation's preeminent pro-Israel lobby. Just how challenging will become more evident on Tuesday when some 6,500 delegates to the annual conference of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee fan out on Capitol Hill for more than 500 separate meetings, 500 meetings with lawmakers and key aides aimed largely at dealing with Iran's nuclear threat against the Jewish state. Quote, tomorrow is the day the rubber meets the road, end quote. AIPAC President David Victor told the conferees Monday before they dispersed for regionally oriented pre-lobbying briefings at the Washington Convention Center. This is a moment of danger. We are the only constituency in America making this anti-Iranian case. Yes, indeed, you are the only constituency in America working for Israel. Foreign agent, anyone? Who is deciding the future of this country? Certainly not average citizens, but well-organized and well-funded lobbies that can take us all to hell. We need to let our representatives know that this is not okay. So please do call your representatives. Thank Representative Lynch for his stance against this, and voice your concern about this march towards another war with Iran. I end this show with my usual listing of the PCHR report highlights for this week. PCHR is the Palestine Center for Human Rights, and for a complete report, you can go to pchrgaza.org. Again, it's a human rights organization that documents in detail weekly incidents and aggression by Israel and breaking of human rights laws against the Palestinians. Again, these are just little pointers. If you want more details, go to the website. And this is news that you won't hear on your local media. Mainstream media. You do hear it on 90.3 Truth and Justice Radio, but probably not many other places. So let's read the highlights of this report. A Palestinian civilian was killed by Israeli forces in the Gaza Strip. Three Palestinian civilians were wounded by Israeli forces in the West Bank. Israeli forces conducted 16 incursions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank and one into the Gaza Strip. Israeli forces arrested 17 Palestinian civilians, including three children in the West Bank and two children in the Gaza Strip. If you want to learn more, by the way, about the children in Israeli prisons, go to the DCI, Defense for Children International, and read the section on Palestine. Israeli forces arrested an old Palestinian woman to pressurize her five sons who are detained in Israeli jails. Israeli naval troops have continued to attack Palestinian fishermen in the Gaza Strip, and they detained five Palestinian fishermen for several hours. Israeli forces conducted excavations to the south of Al-Aqsa Mosque. And by the way, this excavation, they're looking for Jewish temple underneath the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is threatening its structure. Al-Aqsa Mosque is one of the holiest places for Muslims in the world, after Mecca. Israeli forces have continued settlement activities in the West Bank, and Israeli settlers have continued to attack Palestinian civilians and properties. Again, for details on all of this, you can go to the pchrgaza.org. Israeli settlers set fire to a mosque in Yusuf village near Salfit, and Israeli settlers attacked two Palestinian children in Salfit and Hebron. That's it for us today. In the meantime, whisper, talk, or scream, but please do not remain silent. Thank you for listening. Thank you, WZBC, Truth and Justice Radio. Thanks to Mazen Qumsiyeh for joining us today. My email address is selma.abuayash@gmail.com. Send me your comments and feedback or questions on how to find any of the news I shared with you today. Have a great day, and until next time, take good care of our world and of yourselves.
And get involved.